The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
Last week's episode was a big one, featuring some significant developments in the case. As we approach the trial start date, it seems like things are becoming increasingly chaotic, both inside and outside the courtroom. There were two fiery hearings that were held this week, and I'm going to break down what was said, what you may have missed, and also compare what was said in court to what we already know. I'm also going to fact check what was said in open court a little bit. I sat through some of the hearings with my jaw dropped to the floor and had to go back and watch each one again after the shock wore off. The gloves are off, and the situation between Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan and the defense team seems to have become personal. And based on some of the responses and questions from the judge, it's hard not to notice what she seems to already be leaning towards. We have a lot to cover, so let's jump right in. On March 5th, Karen Reed's defense team appeared in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts in front of Chief Judge Frank Dennis Saylor IV. The federal case is seeking habeas relief after the highest court in the state denied Karen's request to drop the two charges that the jury agreed on in her first trial. So Karen's attorney, Martin Weinberg, argued that the double jeopardy protections should be upheld at the federal level, and he would like for the federal judge to have the jurors brought back in to poll them about their not guilty votes for the murder charge and leaving the scene of a crime. Now, Weinberg says a mistrial declaration was not necessary and that the jurors had voted and agreed not guilty on those two counts, but they didn't get to say it in open court because a mistrial was declared without clarifying if they were hung on all three counts. Now, Assistant DA Caleb Schillinger argued for the Commonwealth. He said that there was no final verdict because the verdict can be changed until it's read out loud in court. So basically, it doesn't matter what the jurors are saying that they agreed on since they didn't get the chance to read it in court for the record. How's that for the justice system in action? You impanel a jury to make these huge decisions, but their decisions only matter if they are delivered with the formality that the Commonwealth says is required. Now, Judge Saylor acknowledged that this is a complicated legal issue. The problem is, there's no precedent for a federal judge to dismiss state charges like this, or for a federal judge to conduct an inquiry with the jurors. Now, we saw the jurors being brought in after the Alec Murdoch trial, but that was about alleged misconduct from the court clerk, not about their vote on guilty or not guilty and whether or not they reached a decision. Now, Judge Saylor says that this is somewhat fuzzy, though, because he has to accept the Supreme Judicial Court's interpretation of the state laws, but the state laws don't bind the federal court from looking at this and making decisions. Judge Saylor understands there's another trial quickly approaching, just weeks away, so he says he will issue his opinion as quickly as he can under the circumstances. Mr. Weinberg said that this is a wilderness, and Judge Saylor responded, "It's a thick forest anyway." We'll see what, if anything, comes from it. Aiden Carney, a.k.a. Turtle Boy, was also back in court for his alleged witness intimidation charges against some of the witnesses in the Karen Reed case. Now, the judge heard arguments from each side about where to draw the line about what's protected under First Amendment rights. And apparently, there's a new charge as well. And the prosecutor brought up a situation that he says happened the night before, where Carney and a couple of others were having dinner at C.F. McCarthy's. Then afterwards, Carney walked next door to Chris Albert's pizza place. Now, he didn't enter, but the prosecutor says that Carney walked up to the window, looked in the window, and then stepped back, spent a couple of minutes kind of staring there, and then went on a two-minute, quote-unquote, diatribe, where he spoke to Chris Albert through the video surveillance camera outside.
Spent a couple of minutes just staring there, and then went into a two-minute diatribe. Saying hello to the witness. What have you done? I wish he was alive today. Why did you do that, Chris? He's talking to Chris Albert, the witness. I just want to know. Then he goes on to say, and I have to paraphrase from here, Your Honor, because I didn't get it all down in the brief time that I viewed it. But I know you didn't do it. Colin did it. And then he goes on, essentially to ask why he is covering up for his son, assures him that he's not trying to frighten him. He just wants to know. Just wants to know.
I think he means Colin did it, not Colin. Now, that has been one of the theories about what happened to John O'Keefe, and Carney has been very vocal about his belief that this is true. Now, after that, he says that Carney left and Chris Albert found the video the next morning, as in the same morning of this hearing, and the video was turned over. Now, the prosecutor asked for the court to set bail, set conditions of no contact in the broadest possible sense, and keep Carney within 100 yards of the homes and places of work of the witnesses. Now, when Carney's attorneys are given the opportunity to respond, they're angry. They have no information on this situation. So the judge suspends the hearing for 24 hours, letting them know to be back in court the next day at noon to address it once they've been given the info and had a chance to get a response together. So they came back the next day and gave more information about it and did their arguments. The judge has also watched the video. They're actually playing the video on the news. I'll be honest, it just kind of seems more elementary school than it does felony witness intimidation. You can tell that he's kind of making faces and talking to the camera, but he's on a sidewalk talking to a camera. So I don't know. I guess I don't really see the severity of this being a witness intimidation charge against a camera, but regardless, Carney has to stay away from the witnesses that are part of his indictments, and he has to stay away from D&E Pizza. As far as going to the courthouse, the judge says that Carney enters the courthouse as a journalist, so he is expected to behave as such when he's there, but he's allowed in. For now. Now today, right as I thought I was about done with this episode and ready to release it, up comes a new filing from the Commonwealth. Apparently, Brennan has now requested some of the records from Carney's case to use in the case against Karen Reed. Brennan wants cell phone extractions and intends to use phone records, documents, witness testimonies, and other information that he says demonstrates intimidation of witnesses as consciousness of guilt evidence. The motion says that beginning April of 2023, Karen Reed began sharing defense theories and evidence with Carney through a third-party intermediary. Now, they say that Karen sent witness information, home addresses, grand jury minutes, autopsy photos, and all other evidence to Carney, aka Turtle Boy, and specified certain things that he couldn't or shouldn't share. In the summer of 2023, the Commonwealth is saying that Karen and Carney communicated regularly, and he would sometimes seek permission from Karen or her attorneys before posting something on his social media platforms. Okay, so here's where Brennan makes his giant leap in the motion. He says that a quote-unquote clear inference can be made that Karen Reed and her attorneys directly encouraged Carney to continue personal attacks on witnesses and their family members to deter them from testifying. So a defendant talks to a journalist that she knows believes in her innocence, and Brennan thinks it's a logical leap to assume that she's telling him to attack witnesses? I don't know how this could be allowed in, but I do know that Brennan will try anything to secure a conviction. So we'll see. Maybe this is a way to keep Carney out of the courtroom, since the judge in his hearing wouldn't remove him from there. We'll wait and see what the defense says in their response. First things first, let's talk about ARCA. Again, the defense filed a clarification with the court regarding their statement about ARCA. When the Commonwealth filed their motion to exclude the ARCA experts, the defense responded and said that that was a desperate attempt to keep exculpatory testimony of neutral expert witnesses from reaching the jury, experts that were not hired or paid for by the defense. So the clarification statement is clearing this up by saying that they did not hire them, they did not retain them, they did not pay ARCA to engage in the reconstruction, the analysis, and or testing that was performed by ARCA in connection to this case. The defense did, however, reimburse ARCA for the travel and expenses and time related to getting them to Norfolk twice, plus their time spent testifying in court and the experts' internal preparation for voir dire and trial testimony. So the defense didn't know what, if any, expenses that they would be responsible for covering until the trial had ended, at which point they received guidance from the U.S. Attorney's Office on how to proceed. So basically, they're saying, when we said we didn't pay ARCA, we mean we didn't pay ARCA to do this testing or to come to any conclusions or anything like that. We did reimburse them for expenses that we didn't even know we were going to be charged for, so that they could come tell the jury what they found. Now, in this clarification, the phone calls between Alan Jackson and the ARCA experts, the ones that Brennan had mentioned in the last hearing, they were also included in this. And the reason I thought it was interesting is because Brennan made it seem like Alan Jackson and the ARCA experts had spent significant amounts of time on the phone. But altogether, the time between Jackson and both ARCA experts to coordinate the attendance at voir dire and the trial, plus inquiry about their background, everything, it still only added up to 45 minutes total. And that's not how it was represented, but it's good to know. The attorneys acknowledged that there were times when not everything about the ARCA witnesses was disclosed to all of the defense team. They split up the caseload, so that's not very surprising. But part of Alessi's argument last week was that there is some distinction between who knew what and when. Now, Judge Cannone starts off Tuesday's hearing by addressing this.
You all know that when one of you speak for the entirety of the defense team. When one of you act for the entirety of the defense team. And when one of you makes representations or misrepresentations, you speak for the entire defense team. We all know that. So each attorney is legally accountable for the actions and statements of the entire team.
That argument will be brought back up again later. So Judge Cannone has some more questions about ARCA. Alessi said that after the pause email, there is no more communication in those emails. So you can infer that there was no more conversation happening. Now, Judge Cannone wanted to know if he knows this for a fact or if he is inferring, like he said. Alessi wasn't there. He has everything that he was given and everything that he's able to get his hands on. And based on that, there are no more conversations. But of course, he can't say to the judge that he knows that for a fact. The judge also asks why the record of payment wasn't produced at the same time that they produced the invoice from ARCA. So here's the big deal with this. It isn't a problem that the defense paid the invoice. The problem is that Judge Cannone seems to be upset about the opposition that was filed on February 16th, where the defense attorney's names are on there and it says that they did not pay for ARCA and they had turned over their discovery on ARCA. Now, the opposition wasn't clear. It should have specified that they did reimburse ARCA for their expenses and their time to testify during the first trial. It's one of those distinctions that is small, but also huge. It's not paying someone to do the work. It's paying to have them come tell the jury about the work that they did. So Alessi says that he didn't learn about the payment of the invoice to ARCA until the Sunday night before the hearing on the 18th. So when that opposition was filed, the attorneys did not knowingly misrepresent anything. The way that the ethics rule is written out, Alessi says, is that the attorneys can't be responsible for a misstatement of fact from another attorney unless they have knowledge of the misstatement of fact. And that may be how the rule is, but that's different than how Judge Cannone seems to look at the issue. Well, at least when it comes to the defense, maybe not with the Commonwealth. But with the defense, she seems to want it to be all one big blanket. It's each of their own faults for not knowing and not having a clear representation in the opposition and to her. She still hasn't ruled on this yet, so it's unclear what she's going to do. If she tries to boot Jackson from the case, it will cause massive chaos and delays because of appeals, so it's unlikely that that will happen. I'll be honest, I understand where the defense went wrong here. What I don't understand is why this is causing the judge such a huge reaction. But all of those wild violations from the Commonwealth haven't caused her to even bat an eye. How does that seem balanced? It's harder for me to take this argument seriously, knowing that a payment after the fact didn't impact their testimony any. And how can you take that seriously when all of these issues with Sallyport videos and withholding evidence, when all of that is coming out and she doesn't seem to care about any of that? I don't know. I just don't understand it. But I guess we'll see what she says on that. We'll be right back after this. Now, I've already gone over the motions that were filed to exclude or limit the testimony of the Commonwealth's dog handler. This one is a pretty straightforward one. The judge clearly said Massachusetts law states that only a medical doctor can testify to the causation of wounds. So the defense wants that same limitation put on the dog handler. Now, it may be a pretty straightforward argument, but I do want to point out a couple of highlights. Crosby is an expert on canine behavior. He's not a medical doctor, so he's not qualified to opine on the arm injuries. That's as far as it should have to go. But Alessi also makes a couple of arguments that are interesting. Alessi says that the Commonwealth cited Dr. Crosby's master thesis and said that it was peer-reviewed. So, Alessi went and pulled up that master thesis.
Defining bite mark evidence. A bite mark can be generally defined as a pattern made by teeth in a substrate. A dog bite injury is a pattern injury. Your Honor may recall the absolute probing of Dr. Russell on patterns and the arguments that patterns are a soft science and you can't rely upon them. And lo and behold, Dr. Crosby's first sentence in his master's thesis is a bite mark can generally be defined as a pattern. A dog bite injury is a pattern injury. So I appreciate in his thesis that he confirms Dr. Russell's methodology. What he doesn't do in his thesis is even mention his own methodology that he used here.
So Alessi points out that we spent 2 full days in court while Brennan and the Commonwealth complained about pattern recognition not being enough to identify dog wounds. But here, in their expert's very first sentence, he says it's all about pattern recognition, just like Dr. Russell was saying. Some other things that he points out from the Commonwealth's expert that corroborate what the defense was saying, but kind of contradicts the prosecution. There's no science that backs up matching a dog bite with dog dentition, even though Brennan tried to act like that was reliable and Dr. Russell should have wanted to do that. Alessi says that he then looked at Crosby's PhD thesis, which was recent in 2023. And it's all about dog behavior, not recognizing dog bites. Crosby was a cop for 22 years, but apparently didn't work with police canines, which is surprising. But Alessi points out all of the issues, the lack of qualifications and training, the absence of methodology, and then he closes with this.
In your Honor's opinion about Dr. Russell, stated that it was a close call for Dr. Russell in her ability to testify. If it was a close, no, not if, since it was a close call for Your Honor, I believe it is as distant a call as possibly could be made with Dr. Crosby. So I respectfully request that he be excluded. There's no need for a Daubert hearing. It's plain on the papers, and it's not something that is curable.
I'm glad Alessi quoted that decision from the judge, where she said that it was a close call for her to let Dr. Russell testify, and I'm glad he made that comparison. Alessi says the jury should not have to hear from a dog behavioralist on the cause of injuries to the right arm of the deceased. Now, Brennan's argument is that Dr. Crosby has testified in trials before regarding dog bites, but he doesn't specify what the parameters of that were. Now, I wouldn't be surprised to see if he had testified about dog bites before, but I highly doubt he would have testified about injuries on a person and identified those injuries as dog bites. That's very different. Then Brennan argues this.
It seems as though Attorney Alessi is trying to bind the court regarding a comment of the necessity for a medical doctor. There is no requisite that an expert in this field needs to be a medical doctor. And there is no cases that they provide that bind that limitation. The qualifications of Dr. Crosby are outstanding and significant.
Now, this isn't Alessi trying to bind the court on a comment. That comment was the judge's ruling. This was literally the order from the judge. That's the court's rule. It has nothing to do with Alessi binding anything. It's literally straight from the judge. So Brennan says that the dog behavioralist measured Chloe's teeth and then did estimates on the measurements of the injuries on John's arm using his hospital bracelet as a marker on how big he thinks that they were. And he says, based on that, the injuries were not from Chloe. Now, this doesn't take into consideration the movement or bunching of skin, which was explained by Dr. Russell, but Brennan doesn't think that that matters. Brennan says that Dr. Crosby would potentially be a rebuttal witness after Dr. Russell is called to the stand, but the rebuttal witnesses still have to be qualified. He did absolutely nothing in his argument to answer any of the questions that were raised. Not about methodology, not about what his expert specifically testified about in the previous cases, not about him not being a medical doctor. Those are the issues, but Brennan doesn't address any of them. Instead, he just shifts the blame and the focus as much as possible to attack the other expert. He takes some more digs at Dr. Russell and at Alessi and just completely ignores everything else. Now, as I was trying to finish up this episode, the ruling from the judge came out on this one. I wasn't surprised that it came. Like I said, this one was a pretty easy decision. It's something that the judge has already ruled on previously. Not a medical doctor, can't testify to the causation of wounds. Simple, right? But I was wrong. Not only did Judge Cannone deny the defense's request to exclude the dog behavioralist, but she does it in one paragraph, just saying that the Commonwealth met the foundational requirements of Daubert Lanigan, the evidence will assist the jury, Dr. Crosby is an expert in dog bite wounds, and his testimony, principles, and methods are reliable. Judge Cannone had, 15, 16 hours in court for yet another voir dire of Dr. Russell to make her jump through hoops again and be insulted before she was allowed to testify? Then she issued a 3-page order talking about how it was a close call to allow Dr. Russell to testify again and listening to all the Commonwealth's complaints about her and then putting them in that order. But Brennan brings in a dog behavioralist and the judge is like, no, you didn't address any of the issues that were in the defense's opposition about the clear issues allowing this testimony, but that's okay. I'll approve him, let him testify, and won't even make him do a Daubert hearing. This is one of those motions that I thought was a quick and easy one. She's already made the ruling once before. A biomechanical engineer wasn't allowed to testify about medical causation of injuries. So A dog behavioralist certainly wouldn't be able to. But somehow, I am still getting shocked by what's happening here. I'm actually shocked that she approved it and didn't specify those limitations. They also argued about the meteorologist who had in his report that the ground was hard as a rock. Now, Alessi makes the arguments, and I went over those in the last episode. Brennan basically said he won't ask the expert about the ground hardness at Fairview Road, but he says he does want to ask him about how the ground freezes. Alessi says that talking about how the ground freezes is still problematic because a meteorologist doesn't have the ability to do that without doing proper testing, which he, of course, didn't do. So Alessi is reading off this information to the judge, and she interrupts him and asks him this.
Why don't you put those in writing? Was that just a Google search? I saw that you had it on your...
Actually, Your Honor, the answer is no, it's not a Google search. I actually consulted with the former head of the National Academy of Science on geology, Dr. Donald Siegel, who told me and gave how it is that one determines whether or not ground is even frozen.
A Google search? Really? She just asked Alessi if he's debating the Commonwealth by sitting at the defense table and doing a Google search? Seriously? Do you not know Alessi yet? Of course it's not a Google search. This man met with the former head of the National Academy of Science on Geology. So no. It's not a Google search, Judge. Judge Cannoni says that she's going to take this under advisement. Now, I would assume that this is an easy answer, but this is almost the exact same situation that got the Rantala verdict tossed out. But given the ruling with the dog behavioralist, I won't be so quick to assume that this is going to be quick and easy. She said she's taking it under advisement, so we'll see. Now we get to some of the bigger motions and bigger situations that happened. First, the Commonwealth has filed a motion to impose sanctions against the defense. So the Commonwealth says that the defense violated a protective order by putting some things in their motion that were sealed and should have been redacted. Brennan is really big on accusing the defense of ulterior motives, and the more he does it, the more I think he's actually revealing his own strategy. But Brennan says that the motion that the defense filed that has the sealed stuff in it was basically just a vessel for the defense to use to get that information to the masses. For example, he says that the defense brought up Proctor's text about not watching Jackson's closing, the one where he called him a colorful name. Now, Brennan says that that was part of the defense's public relations campaign to taint the jury pool. Now, here's the way I see this. Anybody who has paid close enough attention to this case to know who Proctor is has already formed their opinion of him based on the disgusting text that we've already heard. Proctor calling Jackson an asshole isn't doing anything for PR. We've already formed our opinions of Proctor. But second, all of this stuff about influencing a jury pool when it comes to this case, do I need to remind you of the video that the Norfolk County District Attorney himself put out? Oh, I'll remind you. Here's Michael Morrissey letting the jury pool know that there's nothing wrong with Proctor and he doesn't have any connections.
Trooper Proctor had no close personal relationship with any of the parties involved in the investigation and had no conflict. And he had no reason to step out of this investigation. Every suggestion to the contrary is a lie.
Of course, we know that turns out to not be true. Now, here's Morrissey's same video telling the jury pool that Karen Reed is guilty and her third-party culprit defense is a desperate attempt to reassign guilt.
The idea that multiple police department, EMTs, fire personnel, the medical examiner, and prosecuting agencies are joined in or taken in by a vast conspiracy should be seen for what it is, completely contrary to the evidence and a desperate attempt to reassign guilt.
Brennan says that there have been statements made by Karen Reed and the defense to the media about Jen McCabe and Brian Albert, as well as others in the house that night, about how they were involved in John's death or the cover-up of it. Brennan says this is a problem because it deals with the credibility of witnesses, and giving a one-sided opinion to the media is concerning. Now, let me remind you of the video that the District Attorney of Norfolk County, Michael Morrissey, sent out to every media outlet to distribute to the jury pool. This is about witness credibility.
Colin Albert didn't commit murder. Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe, and Brian Albert. These people were not part of a conspiracy and certainly did not commit murder or any crime that night. They have been forthcoming with authority, providing statements, and have not engaged in any cover-up. They are not suspects in any crime. They are merely witnesses in the case. To have them accused of murder is outrageous. To have them harassed and intimidated based on false narratives and accusations is wrong.
So, to be clear, it's okay for the DA and the Commonwealth to spread whatever information they choose to the jury pool, but the defendant is not allowed to defend themselves or tell their side. Does Brennan even believe the things he's saying? Probably not, because he's usually a defense attorney. Brennan then does what he often does. He files these motions where he says whatever it is he's going to say, and then the defense gets their response ready, and then they take it before the judge. But Brennan always ends up adding all of this other stuff that wasn't in the motion, and he wants to bring it up and argue that in the most theatrical way possible. This works for him because he puts out a lot of wrong information. And by doing it this way, he can say, oops, I misspoke, instead of it actually being in writing. This was no exception. He did the same thing today. Brennan begins talking about the federal investigation. And the reason that he does it this way is because, once again, he misleads the judge in what he is saying. One of Brennan's quotes that he used in a previous hearing is that a lie unchecked becomes the truth. Well, let's break down his latest accusations and check them, shall we? Brennan basically takes this entire argument about the federal investigation and tries to make the judge and the media believe that the defense was pretty much making it up and it wasn't based in fact.
The defense has not only trampled over 3.6, they've alluded continually about matters that have no basis in fact.
Brennan brings up Yannetti saying that Morrissey's office was the target of the federal investigation. And he quotes Yannetti from January 18th of last year.
District Attorney Morrissey is well aware that he's the target of a federal investigation as a result of his conduct in this case. Those letters prove that he knew that, even before the U.S. attorney ever confirmed that there even was an investigation.
So Brennan brings this up and says that the feds released a statement that said that they had not named a specific target. And the feds never really do. You don't get a text message saying, hey, feds are investigating you. Now, the judge asks where this is, this clip of Yannetti. And of course, it's not in Brennan's motion, and he didn't ever have dates ready, so he just says he'll find it. Now, Ms. Little actually clarifies, since Brennan didn't, that the statement that he's referencing was not said to the media. It was said during a court hearing. Also, Yannetti explains why he says that the target is Morrissey's office, and he references what was said in the letter specifically. But Brennan continues on his tour of complaining about the defense talking about the federal investigation.
He also appeared on court TV with Ms. Reed. The Commonwealth is moving for a protective order for these letters after revealing part of what they contain. The Commonwealth wants to keep the remainder of the letters hidden because the letters contain information that will embarrass District Attorney Morrissey and his office. The letters demonstrate that he's a target of a federal investigation for what his office has done to Karen Reed. This is...
Where was that court TV appearance?
I can get the date for your honor.
So the judge asks again, when was this court TV appearance where David Yannetti is saying all of this? And of course, Brennan doesn't have a date ready for this either. If he had all of the facts, his argument wouldn't be as strong and dramatic. So he doesn't bring any of that. But luckily, I do. That quote-unquote court TV appearance that he just quoted was also from January 18th of 2024. And Yannetti knows this. And when he's given a chance later to speak, he addresses this, saying it wasn't a court TV appearance. This was not an extrajudicial statement by counsel. These were comments made to the judge during court proceedings.
I'd like the court to take a particular care when we're talking about extrajudicial statements, not to take into account statements that were made in advocacy in court to Your Honor. The Commonwealth referenced a statement that I had made regarding the federal investigation. That was in a courtroom setting. It was not an extrajudicial statement.
But Brennan has to get the last little snarky word in.
Correct, he was not in the courtroom.
In case you missed that, Brennan tells Judge Cannone Court TV was not in the courtroom, insinuating that Yannetti is lying. Now, at the end of the next day, Yannetti addresses this in a much calmer manner than I think I would be able to. Instead of any kind of admonishment to Brennan for once again misrepresenting something to her, Judge Cannone asks Brennan again if he has the Court TV interview that he cited. Obviously, he doesn't, since it wasn't from a Court TV interview, so Brennan then backpedals his huge misrepresentation. Again.
I don't know if Mr. Brennan was going to give me a Court TV cite on that. Is right. there one, Mr. Brennan?
I'll have to provide a video. I think that Mr. Yannetti is referring to that comment that was a court comment. And so I intend on remedying that record.
So once again, Brennan is making these big allegations and calling the defense liars so that it goes viral, then quietly backpedaling the corrections. And who is it that's trying to tamper with the jury pool?
You know, it's troubling that he would make this damaging accusation without properly vetting it to see if it is true before he attacks opposing counsel. So that was disappointing. This new false allegation comes after my colleague, Mr. Alessi, co-counsel Mr. Alessi, on February 25th, detailed 9 or 10 false statements that Mr. Brennan has made to this court. And I want to make it clear, I don't need an apology from Mr. Brennan. I don't expect one. But I think perhaps he should apologize to the court. He said today, a lie unchecked becomes the truth. And I just would hope, Your Honor, that you hold Mr. Brennan to the same standard that you hold the defense team. And that's it.
We'll be right back after this. So Brennan made a huge misrepresentation about Yannetti, even arguing with him about the Court TV interview, and eventually had to backpedal his wrong information. Again. But that wasn't the end of it. Brennan continued on his argument about the federal investigation, angry that the defense has brought it up. This time, he aims his disdain at Ms. Little, who brought it up at the hearing on February 18th.
Recently, on February 18th, when we were arguing discovery motions, Attorney Little stood up, invoked the boogeyman, a federal investigation, attached themselves to the Birchmore case, and then proceeded to list off a number of troopers' names with no real association or relevance to any discovery motion. And this was a tactic to besmirch these hardworking, dedicated public servants simply by attaching them to a federal investigation for which there is no boundaries.
Now, to be clear, there are witnesses in the Birchmore case who are also witnesses in this case, which does make it relevant, and the discovery is obviously relevant, and Brennan knows that. He knows the law. He's saying this for show. Brennan then says that within 24 hours of that, the U.S. Attorney's Office contacted the District Attorney's Office and let them know that he is allowed to tell the court that the federal investigation is closed. Now, we discussed this a little bit last week, but Brennan says here he is giving confirmation. Not that Brennan's word means much. Credibility isn't really his thing. Also, the irony is not lost on me that Brennan is up here complaining about the defense talking to media, but he leaked to media that he would be announcing this in court. But listen to what Brennan says next.
So all those implications and innuendos that erode at the objectivity of our potential jury pool, well, they become more egregious when you see that they're not based on reality or fact.
So Brennan is saying to the court that the arguments that Ms. Little made about the federal investigation were egregious because they weren't based in fact. Yannetti addresses this with the judge.
There were allegations that of misconduct regarding the existence or non-existence of the federal investigation specifically directed at Ms. Little. The timeline is important here as well. Mr. Brennan himself was provided and sent a letter on January 30th of 2025. The letter was directed to him specifically. We obviously received a copy of it. The first assistant U.S. attorney, Mary Moraine, informed Mr. Brennan that the federal investigation was ongoing.
So Brennan gets up there and tells the judge how egregious it is that the defense is creating this fantasy about the federal investigation. But he had just received a letter himself addressed to Brennan from the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that the federal investigation is ongoing. That was January 30th of this year. A couple weeks later, Ms. Little gets up and mentions the federal investigation in her request for discovery. Discovery that they all know the defense is entitled to. And Brennan tells Judge Cannone that Ms. Little was trying to incite the boogeyman by mentioning the Fed's investigation. And he says that the defense is making implications and innuendos that erode at the objectivity of the potential jury pool. And this is so egregious because they made the implications that aren't based on reality or fact. Brennan, once again, just got up there and said something that was completely untrue to the judge, knowing it was completely untrue, knowing that by the time he gets corrected, the damage will be done. See, Brennan doesn't need what he says to be factual. If he did, he would put all of this stuff in his motions like a normal prosecutor. No, Brennan just needs a soundbite. And he can't get that from a motion. So he gets up there, says a bunch of stuff that isn't true, and he lets people run with that. He is loud in his wrong accusations, but he is barely audible in his retractions. So after Brennan gets up there and does this little charade, Yannetti gives the real timeline. Now, it's frustrating to have to watch them once again clean up all of his false accusations. And it's frustrating that the judge doesn't require Brennan to give dates and information on these big allegations, especially given his track record here. So she waits for Yannetti to get up there and have to pull all of the dates and get all of the info to argue something that Brennan didn't even put in his motion, and they weren't prepared to have to prove wrong. How is that okay? If one side wants to make a big accusation, it should be that side that has to provide the proof for it. But when you don't have proof, and you only have accusations, you can't do that now, can you? Brennan gets back up and has to tell the judge that he was specifically told about the federal investigation and how it's ongoing on January 30th. Ms. Little made her arguments on February 18th. He says that the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't call to tell him that the federal investigation was over until February 19th. Then, Brennan didn't even tell the defense until February 26th, 1 week before this hearing. I'm going to pull an Alessi and repeat that. Brennan just accused the defense of making arguments about the federal investigation being ongoing, saying that it's egregious because they know it ended, and complaining that they are bringing it up outside of court. But every single time that Brennan mentioned was not only during court proceedings, despite him saying otherwise, but they were also all during the time that the federal investigation was still ongoing. Brennan gets busted again, and of course switches up his argument again, saying that, well, it wasn't that they were saying it was ongoing, it's that they were saying that there's something happening in federal court. That's not what he said. That's his backup argument when he gets called out for lying again. So what does Brennan want? Well, for starters, he wants complete control over the defense. He wants a gag order in place where none of the defense attorneys are allowed to talk after court on the courthouse steps anymore to reporters, and where they're not allowed to do any more interviews. And what's worse, he also wants all of the defense filings to be sealed until he has a chance to look at them and make sure that there's nothing he objects to before they're made public on the docket. He didn't say anything about his being sealed, just the defense. Now, if you thought that they were hiding stuff from the public before, oh, buddy, that ain't nothing compared to the silencing that they're trying to do now. Also, I know I keep pointing out the irony in all of this, but the argument that Brennan made about why they should be allowed to silence the defense was all about misinformation. And it's ironic that his argument to put this gag order in place was literally all misinformation. Make it make sense. Unetti acknowledged that he did not file a motion to impound the stuff that is supposed to be sealed. He said it was an oversight, and he knows that there were some things that should have been redacted. It was a mistake. He knows that. He owns it. He owns it in front of the court. He says that when he included the part about Proctor's text in the motion, he didn't think of that in terms of being part of the protected information. When he saw Brennan's motion, he said he looked and realized it was protected, so he called Brennan. Unetti says the whole point of the protective order was to establish privacy and safety for witnesses and to protect the integrity of ongoing investigations. And the disclosure here didn't undercut any of that. Unetti apologized for the oversight, but honestly, of all the oversights, this is the least detrimental to the situation. So we'll see what comes from it. On the next episode, we're going to get into the motion to dismiss arguments. We hear more about the Sallyport. We hear a new report from Buchanick. And things get heated between the judge and Alan Jackson. The jury tampering allegations are addressed, and the judge is mad. Plus, there will be more filings on the docket, we can be sure of that. I wanted to put that in this week's episode, but there's just too much. And also, I've done a little digging. So, next week's episode will be a little spicy. All that and more next week.
My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.